expected for later this year. So what we're seeing right now is a very thoroughgoing development towards a full-blown military dictatorship in Pakistan, which is taking place with the support of ostensibly democratic parties who have co-signed the marginalization of democracy in Pakistan for many years to come.
Murtaza Hussain, I want to thank you so much for being with us, senior writer at The Intercept. We're going to link to his piece, Secret Pakistan Cable Documents U.S. Pressure to Remove Imran Khan. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, high heat is linked to the deaths of at least two people this week in the Portland area. How to make sure the kids are up to date on their immunizations before school starts.
Right now, the recommendation is that everybody get updated with a bivalent COVID vaccine.
And what's behind the latest troll sightings in the Pacific Northwest? We take a closer look. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 17th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. At least two local deaths are linked to the intense heat we've experienced this week. The Multnomah County Medical Examiner is investigating two people found dead as possibly heat-related, as temperatures soared above 100 for several days. The University of Washington's Dr. Christy Ebi serves as a global health professor. Here, she explains why the heat can be so dangerous.
The headline statement is people are unnecessarily suffering and dying from the heat. There's deep understanding of how heat affects our bodies. And there's deep understanding about what needs to be done to protect people during hot periods of time. And therefore, all heat-related deaths are potentially preventable. One of the challenges we face is the very low awareness about heat as a health risk. I spoke about mortality. When we think about periods of high temperature, there's also impacts on occupational health and productivity. We know there's increased sports injuries and illnesses. There's adverse pregnancy outcomes. The list of the most vulnerable during a heat wave is quite long. Adults over the age of 65, people who've got chronic medical conditions, people who work outside, pregnant women, the list goes on. And so there's lots of people who need to be paying more attention, need to be motivated to make some changes during heat waves. But unfortunately, a natural part of the aging process is people become less well able to tell they're getting into trouble with the heat. So even if they know that it's hot outside, they don't necessarily make changes in their behavior that would help prevent heat stress. When we think about the impact of heat on our bodies, we focus on our core body temperature. This is not the temperature you measure with a thermometer. This is the internal temperature in our body. And that needs to be maintained within a pretty narrow range to protect our cells and our organs. I'm often asked, what is that core body temperature? First of all, it's not terribly used because people don't know what their core body temperature is. But second of all, there's lots of factors that increase or decrease the core body temperature. So it's not just heat, but we have to think about our infrastructure. We have to think about the behaviors people undertake during a period of hot weather. It's quite hot. People go and find a shady place to be. They find some place by the water to cool down. So there's lots of ways that people can help keep that core body temperature down. And I'll make the point again, it doesn't have to be with air conditioning. We know from the Lancet countdown that exposure to heat waves has been increasing. I have the data here for 2020. These are worldwide data that adults over the age of 65, a group at particular risk, there were 3.1 billion more person days of exposure over the long-term average. It's a summary about the spectrum of heat illness, going everything from a heat rash all the way to heat stroke. Heat stroke is a medical emergency and requires immediate medical intervention. And even with medical intervention, the mortality rate is high, and people who survive heat stroke often have lifelong consequences. Heat-related mortality is significantly underestimated. When you look at the official numbers, it's about 700 Americans die every year from the heat. There's a couple of studies that have modeled using the kinds of approaches that are being used for COVID, of looking at the number of excess deaths. And one particular model estimate was 12,000 annual deaths. So this is a big impact right now, and of course is anticipated to get much worse with climate change. When we talk about heat and health, we need to think about inequities. There is lots of ways that heat exacerbates current inequities. You think about where people live. Think about the red line districts. Those districts are hotter than surrounding areas. They don't have trees or have fewer trees. And so there's lots of interactions between heat and inequity, and very pleased to see increasing coverage of that. There's been coverage, for example, for farm workers and how the heat really exacerbates the inequities that they already experience. And there's lots of ways to protect individuals and communities. Heatwave early warning and response systems save lives. We know that they work. There's not enough of them. And for almost all of them, including some of the very good ones in the U.S., there's ways they can be improved. Thinking for the longer term, a heat action plan also incorporates thinking about our infrastructure. I live in Seattle. You go downtown, there's cranes everywhere. We continually rebuild. And think about what the building codes are going to be. Are you going to require every building to have a white roof, building over a certain size to have a green roof? And so thinking about that longer term planning so that you have the short term emergency heat wave and response system, and you've got the longer term planning. When we look into the future, the magnitude and the pattern of the future health risks are going to depend on the extent of both adaptation and mitigation. In the short term, on the adaptation, the heat wave early warning systems, education and training, lots of changes to be made to increase awareness of the health risks of heat. And I have some numbers here from the study that modeled the 12,000 annual deaths projected at the end of the century without adaptation and mitigation. There could be an additional 100,000 or so deaths from heat without taking action. And so overall, there's urgent requirements for investments in research and in risk management.
That's global health professor Dr. Kristi Ebi at the University of Washington. Two of the biggest healthcare systems in Oregon and Southwest Washington announce merger plans.
Hello, I'm Danny Jacobs, president of Oregon Health and Science University.
And I'm Catherine Crea, president and chief executive officer of Legacy Health.
We have the honor and privilege of leading two of the Pacific Northwest's most prominent and well-respected health systems.
And we're here today to share some important news that will fundamentally transform healthcare in our region.
OHSU and Legacy are joining forces to create a single, comprehensive, and integrated health system. We're excited about what this means for our patients, our families, and loved ones.
OHSU and Legacy have a strong history of collaboration, and because of that, we know that together, we can vastly improve and expand access to healthcare and preventative medicine.
With a shared mission to support health and well-being, we will draw on Legacy's deep experience providing the highest quality community-based care.
And OHSU's expertise as a leading academic health sciences university serving complex patient needs along with nationally and internationally recognized research and education programs. Coming together will create a stronger patient-focused and community-facing health system where more patients will be able to get the exceptional care that they deserve when it's needed.
Together, we will be able to expand opportunities for our learners. It will also increase our ability to identify new and better ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat illness.
This next step will enable us to anchor Oregon and Southwest Washington as a national and global leader in patient and community-focused healthcare, health and science education, and innovative research.
We are committed to creating an inclusive, empowering, and welcoming environment that attracts, educates, and retains world-class healthcare education and science professionals, as well as learners.
You know, at the end of the day, it's always about people. Our 32,000 dedicated employees and the millions of people we will reach through teaching, healing, and discovery.
As we go forward, we will not underestimate the magnitude and significance of what we're about to do in our joint responsibilities. We'd like to thank everyone for their continued commitment and enthusiasm as we embark on this transformational journey.
The merger would still need to get an okay from regulators. It's almost fall, almost time for new immunizations to protect people from COVID, flu, and RSV. I talked to Dana Deshaun with the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're saying that it's important for parents to take their kids in for a well child visit before the fall and winter respiratory season starts. Why is that important?
Yeah, definitely important. So while we know we're kind of in this, let's get everybody ready for school. And so we like to get everybody up to date. We like to see kids to just to make sure that they're growing well, that their developmental milestones are where they need to be. But it also gives us that great opportunity to make sure that they are protected against illnesses like measles and whooping cough and other serious diseases by getting them caught up on their vaccinations. We know with the COVID-19 pandemic that we lost out on a lot of vaccinations, and we call those zero dose children. So those are kids that didn't get any vaccines. We've done pretty good. We're definitely catching up, but we're still at pre-pandemic levels of getting kids up to date on those immunizations. And the important part about that is that we need to rev up for our illness season that, you know, usually starts up as early as October with seeing influenza, RSV, and continuing to see COVID-19 infection.
Yeah, I am seeing that there is an uptick in reports of COVID-19 infections. Does the current vaccine protect against the latest variant?
Yeah, that's a great question out there. I believe that the vaccine will give coverage against the coronavirus that's out there, and that bivalent. Right now, the recommendation is that everybody gets updated with a bivalent COVID vaccine in the best protection against serious disease of COVID-19 infection. And as you said, even though it was announced that the pandemic was over come May, we are still definitely seeing pockets and new developments of COVID-19 infection. And the concern is when kids go back to school and around everybody or daycares or preschools, then we're going to see even more of the infection going around.
Mm-hmm. And it's possible we could see a new vaccine coming out as soon as September or early October. And if that is the case, would you recommend that parents hold off until then and then bring their kids in? Or would you say go ahead and get the bivalent if they haven't had it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I wish I had a bubble that would say, you know, but we know that the benefit of getting a vaccine for that prevention for what may be currently out there is well worth it. And so at this point, the recommendation is that if you have not gotten that updated bivalent, which for most, if you're over 5 years of age, that's just one. Now, if those kids between 6 months to five might need more than one of that bivalent, depending on what they've gotten in the past. But that will definitely give potentially that protection against those serious effects of the COVID disease. And then I would say, once it comes out and approved, then yes, we should continue to give that extra protection that a new COVID vaccine would give with the variant as well.
For people who are still concerned about the safety of the vaccine, how was the COVID-19 vaccine for children developed and approved?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there was a lot of confusion and concern because it did come out very quickly. And we have to realize that this was just not the United States. This was all over the world. We were trying to figure out what to do with protecting people against this virus. But particularly the mRNA vaccine that we use in children is not a new vaccine. For decades, really, scientists have been developing vaccines against other coronaviruses, such as SARS and MERS, which are acute respiratory syndromes. And then these scientific advances laid a strong foundation for the development of COVID-19 vaccines. We've also used the mRNA vaccine in cancer research against specific cancer cells since a stem cell transplant. Developing new vaccines for the public involves numerous regulatory steps. So we know when we develop those vaccines, they have to go through certain phases. So phase 1 to 4, and those all have to go through that before they are having any authorization or approval. And the two biggest factors that we look at with that is definitely safety and then effectiveness. And then before the FDA authorizes COVID-19 or really any vaccines for children 5 and under, scientists, they conduct clinical trials with thousands of children to establish looking at that safety and effectiveness.
And after the vaccine was approved, how does the FDA continue to monitor the safety for children who are getting the vaccine?
Right, yeah. So for any vaccine, even before we see approval, we have ways of looking at safety on that. So, but once it's approved, there are systems that are in place and have been in place since the beginning of doing reporting for vaccines that come out. So the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, we call that VAERS, and the Vaccine Safety Data Link, and the CDC's Clinical Immunization Safety Assessment Project. But then particular to the COVID-19 vaccine is when we came out with the V-Safe After Vaccination Health Checker. So really what happens with that is that if there is any sort of safety signal that comes through any of those reporting systems, what happens is that vaccine, there is a halt. And so they will not continue to give that vaccine. They will closely look at that safety signal and then make sure that that is not linked to the vaccine.
Okay. We've been talking about the COVID vaccine. Let's talk about some of the other vaccines that you would recommend that kids get before they go back to school.
Yeah. So we know there's particular grades that kids need their vaccine. So going into kindergarten, they need to have their measles, mumps, and rubella. They need to have their chickenpox vaccine. They need to have their polio vaccine. And they need to have their diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine. So, and then when they go between 11 and 12, usually into sixth grade, we have their tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis vaccine. They have their meningitis vaccine and their HPV vaccine. And then those kids that are 16 and older, so in those high school levels, we have two types of meningitis vaccine. So that protects against meningitis for those kids. And then, you know, as they go into school, there are all the other vaccines that are still important, like hepatitis A, hepatitis B. Those are ones that we give when kids are little, but if they haven't gotten those up to date, which during the COVID pandemic, we definitely saw a lag of kids getting in or kids that didn't get any vaccines. And so going into preschool, so those three-year-olds, so there's other vaccines that they may be needing. And then I would encourage, obviously, to talking to with their child's nurse practitioner or other healthcare provider to see exactly what they're due for.
What about the flu and the RSV vaccines? Are those recommended for kids?
Yeah, thank you. So at this point, we don't have any approval on the RSV for kids. For adults, there's a vaccine, but there's definitely something coming down the pike that we're super excited about getting some protection against that. The influenza vaccine is out, and I know at least in my office, we are going to be start giving out that flu vaccine very soon. And it, you know, it's developed to really look at what we think from what we've looked at across the world in other parts. And so particular to what may be circulating this year. And we had a pretty not so great flu, and we had about 166 pediatric deaths last year. And then the COVID-19, we recommend everybody get their updated bivalent vaccine if they have not gotten that, to get them all up to date and protected before everybody's all back together.
And we know that a lot of vaccines, they don't just work immediately. They actually take some time to get into the body before they do their, you know, before they start protecting you. So how far ahead of the start of school should children be vaccinated?
Yeah, so right now, right? So we should be in there. So, you know, there's some, depending on the vaccine, you know, some of them you get some protection within a couple weeks, and some of them it might be more of many weeks with that. But as you get that vaccine, and some of them need more than one dose. So with kids between 6 months to up to 5 years of age, they may need two or three. But certainly we know with getting one vaccine will give them some protection. But certainly I would recommend making sure you're getting that full series for that. Like for the flu vaccine, if those kids are little and under nine, sometimes that first year they have to get two to make sure that they get that full protection.
Dana Deshaun is a pediatric nurse practitioner. A new art installation brings trolls to the Pacific Northwest, and one has made its home here in Portland. KBOO's Zoe Carina has more on the story.
On Tuesday, August 12th, Portland welcomed a troll into the city. The larger-than-life statue is meant to inspire people to explore and protect the outdoors. This troll is part of Danish artist Thomas Dambo's Way of the Bird King series. Based across the United States, the series centers the trolls as protectors of natural life. Five trolls will be located in the Pacific Northwest. Each troll will be made with the help of volunteers around Oregon and Washington. Volunteers will use recycled wood materials, including old wood pallets, to build the trolls. The Portland troll will live on the Nordic Northwest campus for 3 years. The four remaining trolls will be hidden throughout coastal Salish lands. Local artists from the Muckleshoot and Snoqualmie tribes are collaborating on the project. Explorers can use the Troll Map website to find them after they are built. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Zoe Carina.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. We'll have the Global Citizen International Digest with PSU Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, a low down to 61. Tomorrow's weather, clouds in the morning, sunny in the afternoon, a high of only 83 degrees. Today in history, on this date in 1969, the Woodstock Music Festival came to an end. Our quote of the day is from Richie Havens. Woodstock was both a peaceful protest and a global celebration. Georgia election workers who say they were harassed by former President Trump seek justice. House Republicans want to repeal the Home Rule Act in D.C. And people in Ohio aim to create a new redistricting commission to end gerrymandering. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
The President of the United States is supposed to represent every American, not to target one, but he targeted me.
Fulton County, Georgia election worker Ruby Freeman told the House January 6th committee nowhere feels safe since former President Donald Trump labeled her a professional vote scammer following the 2020 presidential election. Her repeated harassment was included in the racketeering charge against Trump and his alleged co-conspirators by Fulton County grand jurors this week. A lawyer for Freeman, along with her daughter and fellow election worker Shay Moss, says they are seeking accountability for those who led and profited from the smear campaign. Meanwhile, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp tells CNN his fellow Republicans need to move on from the 2020 election.
You know, if you look in the rearview mirror too long while you're driving, you're going to look up and you're going to be running into somebody, and that's not going to be good.
Kemp says the election in Georgia was not stolen and refutes Trump's claim he holds evidence of election tampering, which he says he plans to release soon in a detailed report. A U.S. appeals court has ruled new restrictions should be imposed on the abortion pill mifepristone. However, the ruling will not go into effect until the Supreme Court hears the case on appeal. The drug remains available for now. House Republicans have introduced a bill to repeal the D.C. Home Rule Act, abolish its local government, and grant all governing authority to Congress. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton says it would be undemocratic.
I don't think there's any chance that we'll lose home rule. In fact, we're trying to go the other way. We're trying to become the 51st state.
The bill's supporters say it's an effort to rein in violent crime in the capital city. Ohioans are collecting signatures for an amendment to their state's constitution to allow a citizen-led redistricting committee to draw the state's congressional and legislative maps. Common Cause Ohio's Catherine Terser tells NBC several maps drawn by a GOP-led commission have already been deemed unconstitutional.
We clearly these folks are drunk on power. And what do you do with drunks? You take away their keys.
Tercer says a citizens' commission would be split evenly between registered Republicans, Democrats, and independents. A federal judge has temporarily blocked a Mississippi state law limiting who can assist voters with disabilities in returning their completed mail-in ballots. Republican lawmakers argue limits are needed to prevent so-called ballot harvesting, but they were unable to provide data to the court proving the claim. And a Kansas prosecutor says he found insufficient evidence to support the recent police raid of a weekly newspaper and said all seized material should be returned. Press freedom groups have sharply condemned the raid. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Throughout the U.S. and the world, unarmed and skilled de-escalation teams are preparing for the worst of times. As Farah Siddiqui reports, this comes as conflicts and violence rise, and elections are right around the corner.
When Missouri Congresswoman Cori Bush needed assistance after threats during her 2020 election campaign, she turned to unarmed civilian protection in St. Louis. UCPs are especially trained to de-escalate even the worst scenarios. Eli McCarthy with the D.C. Peace Team says a highly skilled UCP unit uses many nonviolent resources, such as centering and different forms of dialogue, listening and acknowledging feelings and needs.
Things like distraction and delegation, dignity phrases, interconnectedness phrases, for example, like, we are in this together, let's find a way through this. And then other tactics like interposition, so different ways they can use their bodies to get in between, to walk.
McCarthy says unarmed civilian protection is practiced in war zones such as South Sudan, Colombia, Iraq, and the Philippines. As we gear up for the next election in November 2024, some national organizations are already planning for and asking for de-escalation training from the DC Peace Team. McCarthy says training and deployment of the UCP unit for election poll places, faith-based groups, and those involved in the election process who are feeling directly threatened or at risk can be beneficial.
You know, one option is you hire an unarmed civilian protection team or unit to provide kind of regular accompaniment and really try to put that person more at ease so they can focus on their work. You know, Cori, I don't have to look over my shoulder and be on constant alert.
DCPT is part of a broader network known as the Shantycena Network. It comprises members from peace teams from around the U.S. and Canada and is open to members worldwide. I'm Farah Siddiqui.
America's oil producers expect to hit an all-time high output of 12.8 million barrels a day this year. As Erica Lottis reports, a new fight is underway in Congress over changing rules to favor oil companies.
Two bills making their way through Congress could throw out over 216,000 public comments on the U.S. Bureau of Land Management's new rule, which has come under fire from the fossil fuel industry for putting conservation and outdoor recreation on par with extraction on lands owned by all Americans. Madeline West with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership says she supports the agency's plan to restore millions of acres of degraded public lands.
Lands that, if improved, could be better for agriculture and grazing production, could provide higher quality habitat for species, could provide better access for recreation, including hunting and fishing.
House Resolution 3977 and Senate Bill 1435, which call for the BLM to stop gathering and to discard public input on its draft public lands rule, could get a floor vote when Congress reconvenes after Labor Day. The American Petroleum Institute claims the new rule violates the BLM's mandate to manage public lands for multiple uses and to prioritize the nation's need for domestic minerals, including oil and gas. Over 90% of lands managed by the BLM would remain open for mining and drilling under the new rule. Chaffee County Commissioner Keith Baker believes the industry's concerns are overblown, pointing to a recent report that the nation's oil output will hit an all-time high in 2023.
So I don't think our petroleum industry is really in any near-term danger of being crippled by giving conservation and recreation an equal par with the more extractive traditional industries.
Conservationists say public comments largely in favor of the BLM's proposal show that Americans care about healthy land, water, and wildlife and want to see these values endure for generations. West believes the new rule provides the tools needed to manage a host of 21st century challenges.
The spread of wildfire and the cycle of invasive annual grasses and fire exacerbated by drought. We have modern management challenges, and the BLM has old, outdated regulations guiding how they can respond.
This is Eric Gladys reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 17th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Zoe Carina, Eric Galatis, and Farah Siddiqui. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, featuring the Global Citizen International Digest with PSU Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State.